from the Hill Country in Texas, broadcasting worldwide, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.
Is OneRadioNetwork.com. The telephone number is 888-663-6386. Email patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com.
Well, here we are, hour two of our little show. Sorry about the internet outage this morning earlier as you're listening to this podcast. It was just one of those karmic things. I guess we could blame it on Mercury. Or the homeopathic vet gods from the other dark side. I don't know. But last week we had a kind of a problem. Dr. Faulkner had some things going on at his place and we couldn't do the show, but now we're back on this morning and then the internet, well, whatever. Dr. Will Faulkner is here and we have some emails already and I suspect we're going to be back here live anyway, but Doc is a good man. He has been a homeopathic vet for a very long time. He's out in the Austin area, kind of South Austin. Dr. Faulkner, good morning.
Good morning, Patrick.
Boy, I thought we had the homeopathic karma thing coming down. I don't know what it is.
Don't blame it on homeopathy.
That's right. That's right. It's something. Don't blame it on
shadow of Mercury or something.
Yeah,
crazy.
It's shadow of Mercury. How are you doing, Doc?
I'm doing really well.
Yeah.
I'm loving spring, and I'm glad to be back in Austin again for several months. So.
Yeah,
all's good.
Yeah, you go back and I'll go back and visit your spiritual teacher in India quite several times a year, huh?
Yeah, it's turned out to be one long trip and one short one. So I'll go again in July and then again in the fall. I'll be there for several months.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, what part of India?
It's called Uttar Pradesh up north.
So, yeah,
pretty country.
Yeah. Well, what kind of got you over to the homeopathic side? Were you a traditional vet? I don't know if I've ever asked you that long ago.
Yeah. Well, we all started out that way, you know. So about 7 years in, I just had this intuition that it was time to do something else. And I didn't really even know what it was. I wasn't even sure if it was being a vet. So I had this intuition. I was following some folks who at the time said, you know, your intuition isn't there to screw you up. You should listen to it. So I came home and laid down next to my wife and said, you know, honey, I'm quitting tomorrow.
Wow.
And she said, oh, my God, really? What happened? I said, well, it's just that intuition. You know, we've been listening to those folks that are preaching about intuition being important, so I'm going for it.
Mm-hmm.
And my practice members, I was a partner at the time, and I was happy as a clam, and the clients and the farmers all liked me, and no one could understand what happened, but that was what propelled me into, it was kind of almost like a jump off a cliff. I didn't know where I was going to land, but if I hadn't gotten out of that conventional practice, it was kind of like working for my dad.
Yeah,
I would have still been a conventional vet today, but ended up, after kind of bouncing off the cliff a couple of times, finding that, gosh, yes, I'm a vet. I want to be a vet. I want to work with animals, but there's got to be another way to do it. And I started learning about these insertions of fine needles that people were doing and these giving of remedies that had nothing physical left to them and getting cures of things that conventional medicine wasn't touching. And I went, wow, that's fascinating. So I just retooled.
Yeah.
I basically studied all over again. And when I landed on the first veterinary homeopathy course for professionals, it was like coming home. It was just like, oh yeah, this is my medicine.
Huh.
This is so neat.
And what year was that when you?
That was 91, 92. And there's probably about 40 of us, 50 of us in the class. And we traveled back and forth to Eugene, Oregon to study with Dr. Pitcairn, who was still is kind of the father of veterinary homeopathy in this country. He went through all the studies and tried all the crazy ideas and found that really what worked was the tried and true that was discovered 200 years earlier, started applying it to animals and then started teaching vets. And boy, it was just like a fortuitous coming together of lots of good understanding and a way to practice that just made a whole lot more sense.
And how do you determine dosage and the right homeopathic medicine for? Because you do a lot of consultations with people long range. You don't actually have to see the animal, correct? Yeah. How do you determine which one?
Well, it's got to be a working team. So I've got to have an owner who's really aware of their animal. Mm-hmm. They know what normal looked like, and they can describe to me how abnormal now looks. And so there's a little bit of a learning curve, but when I'm consulting with someone, I'll ask them a series of questions. So if they say, you know, my dog's had diarrhea, well, I've got at least three more questions about that before we're done with that subject. You know, is there straining? Is it foul smelling? Is it weirdly colored or full of mucus? And what time of day does it happen? And I had a case in the office yesterday that was a really interesting one, transmissible venereal tumor.
Wow.
I think dogs are the only one that get a kind of a tumor that's actually a contagious tumor. So we had just a grand time talking about this dog while the dog wandered the room and, you know, got to the physical exam toward the end and the dog's already comfortable with me. But I can do the same thing on the phone. It's just really getting a bead on what are the symptoms that this dog portrays. The yesterday case, which is so fresh in my mind, the dog has been itching since probably shots, was a rescue and got a bunch of shots. And I said, tell me more about the itch. When does it happen? And she said, you know, this dog has a fine morning and sleeps all night. But as the day gets older, the itch picks up. And I said, tell me more. What time of day? And she said, well, about 5 p.m. and it might go on till 9 p.m. And I immediately eliminated a whole bunch of remedies in my mind because there aren't but about 20 that have a worsening in the afternoon or evening. So now I'm pared down to a fewer bunch, and this dog has a venereal condition. The vulva on this poor female is swollen, and it's only swollen on the right side. When I lift her tail, it's like one half of her vulva is five times as big as the other half, and they're calling it a transmissible venereal tumor. So I said, well, now I've got a couple of points in favor of this remedy. It's a right-sided remedy I'm thinking about. It's worse in the evening, and it's got genitalia involved. So I can do that over the phone, too, if I've got enough information. Sometimes it's funny, though, because you got to keep asking and keep probing. I had a dog in, I think it was Florida or maybe Houston or somewhere, only on the phone, and we were treating this dog for a crazy itch, which is the number one reason dogs see vets.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, it's the commonest thing. And I wasn't getting anywhere, and I'm probably on my 10th or 12th prescription. And finally, the owner just voluntarily said, you know, I've never mentioned this to you, Dr. Falconer, but this dog is intact, and she's never had a normal heat. She's about 4 years old.
Wow.
And I went, whoa.
Yeah.
Tell me about that. What does that look like? Well, they're too short, or they come too late, or there's no males interested in her at all. And I went, oh, my gosh, I think you just unlocked the case for me. So she didn't come to me about that, but that was a real important key piece of this dog's illness. She never had a normal reproduction cycle. So it turned out we could find a remedy that had that and itchy skin and whatever third or fourth thing that she had for a symptom, and lo and behold, she started getting better on the itch when I learned that and could choose remedies based on that.
I'll be done. Dr. Will Falconer, his website is vitalanimal.com. So the itch thing, you know, for my girl and lots of it comes kind of in the spring and the summer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it get all winter, you know, I was going to call you again.
But they're good.
Yeah, yeah, they're good. And then all of a sudden, so I'm real curious. In people, Dr. Falconer, we conjecture, and we don't know, but we conjecture that the whole allergy thing is somehow related to a gut issue where you're breathing in a pollen, mm-hmm. you know, and the gut doesn't do or leaky. Do you think it's similar with the four-leggeds?
I think we probably have
pollens and grasses and stuff. Pollens.
Yeah, I think we have more similarities than differences, Patrick. It's really, we're all mammals, you know, so we have very similar symptoms and very similar parts of us that react. The difference, the main difference in allergies between dogs and humans is our organ of reactivity is usually respiratory, right? We get sneezy and
runny
eyes.
Right.
And the dogs get itchy and the cats get itchy. And the horses pretty much do too if they're allergic to something. But what I've found over the years is that it's all man-made stuff. It's not the pollen's fault, right? Normal reaction to pollen would be no big deal.
You sneeze or whatever.
Not get anything. No. Yeah, maybe a sneeze here and there, but it's not life-threatening. And these guys who are allergic, they have misperception on the immunological level. They're seeing it as a huge threat, and they're reacting violently to it. So what creates immune dysfunction? Well, in my practice, what I've noticed over the years is it's the vaccines.
Wow.
You can predict 80% of the time that if somebody gets a shot on day one, by day 30 or 40 or 45, you're going to see some signs of often itchiness, whether it's ears or skin or both. And that's been observed for decades now. And of course, that's not something that a conventional vet is going to look that long to see, right? They'll say, well, I gave a shot on Friday and the dog's okay on Monday, so we're good.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look out a little longer and you see, well, wait, this dog's coming back in now for itch, what's going on? They don't ask that question. They just see it's as a new disease. And now they're off busy trying to fight the itch. So that's been the number one linchpin in my understanding, and a lot of my colleagues have seen it too. Now that they're aware through our training that if you look out about a month, you'll see it.
But you have to then find a specific and not just a general off-the-shelf homeopathic to help the body heal from that vaccine that could be 4, 5, 6 years ago?
Yeah, and it varies individual to individual. So I wish it were simpler. The itch is probably one of the harder diseases to cure, although it can be cured with homeopathy and cannot with any drugs that are on the market. It's just impossible. They suppress the symptoms. They don't cure the dog. But we'll find there's a handful of vaccinosis remedies, and unless we pull them in at some point and find the one that best matches that particular patient and their symptoms, we're typically stuck. We get them better to a point, but they don't keep going. They don't go all the way to cure, which is what we want. We want to put ourselves out of work. We want to say, your animal's so well, you don't need me anymore.
Yeah.
That's really our goal.
Hmm.
And we don't get there. And that was something Pitcairn discovered early on. He was doing really careful classical homeopathy, one remedy at a time. Same remedies we use for you and I, you know, same remedies that have been known for 200 years. But he only got him to a certain point, and then he couldn't get him further and couldn't get him to cure, and he'd look back at their history and go, huh, I wonder if these vaccines had something to do with it, because they sure did in human literature that he was reading. So he'd go back in and find a vaccinosis remedy, so-called, choose one that fit the patient the best, give it to him, and the case would start moving again, and they'd be able to march him along to cure.
And are there a lot of vaccinosis remedies?
There's a handful. I think the group is probably 10 or 15 strong, but the top three are Thuja, T-H-U-J-A,
yeah,
and silica, just like the element silica, and sulfur in homeopathic form. Those are all closely associated with vaccinosis and the consequences of illness coming from vaccines.
Dr. Faulkner, do you think it's the actual vaccines themselves or all the adjuvants and tag-alongs that they put in the vaccines or both?
Well, it's both,
is
Patrick.
It?
It's a great question. Long before we had all the adjuvants added and long before they stuck mercury in the vaccines, way back to the day of smallpox, we saw people getting chronically ill after getting vaccinated. And they were ill in a myriad of ways. They had chronic headaches, or they had, you know, allergies, some really horrible cases. There's a little book I often quote when I'm teaching called Vaccinosis and Its Cure by Thuja, which was written 150 years ago by a homeopath out of Britain. And he tells these horrendous cases of people who've just been suffering, you know, from having gotten the smallpox shot long before mercury, long before aluminum was added. just from getting a shot. So yeah, it's both. I think today we're in a more of a pickle because we do have these adjuvants to, you know, make a local reaction stronger. That's the aluminum, and to preserve it, that's the mercury, and both of those are neurotoxic, and so we got a whole another layer of complication now going on.
Yeah. When I got Doodle, she was about six weeks old from a, you know, just a couple that breeded her with a poodle and a golden retriever in San Antonio.
Sure.
You know, not a breeder. They just jumped over the fence. Hey, why don't you guys make babies? And right. She's a great dog. but they, when I got her, and I didn't know at the time, you know, then he gave me a little piece of paper and said, oh, we gave her these vaccines. And I think there was two or three. And so even these little guys at 4 weeks old and that, I don't know what they give them. What do they traditionally give these dogs, those three?
Well, typically it's a five-way vaccine, or at least four nowadays. So it's usually DHLP, which is distemper, hepatitis, which is pretty much unheard of these days, parvo, and parainfluenza.
Right. So are we any risk if we don't do those to those little dogs?
Well, I mean, it depends. If you do nothing at all, yeah, you could have some risk. But I have animal owners come in regularly and say, you know, I've learned enough about vaccines from you and others that I don't want to do them. Can we raise this puppy in a safe way? And I'll refer them to a couple of things. One is I've got a page on my site called Preventing Parvo Without Vaccination, I think is what the article is. It's on my blog.
Yeah.
If you just search the word parvo, you'll pull it up on my vitalanimal.com site. And I'll have them do that, which is a slow kind of a metered exposure to the world about them where dogs congregate. Parvo is pretty much everywhere dogs are. And I'll have them do what's called a homeopathic prophylaxis using a nosode. And a nosode is just a remedy made in the same safe, diluted fashion that all remedies are made. So there's nothing toxic about it or nothing dangerous about it, but it's like an energetic impulse to say, if you see this parvo coming your way, you mount a response, don't let it in. And we alternate parvo 1 week and distemper the other, and we do that just until they're 9 months old, when their immune system is really pretty much mature and ready to take on the world. So I'll have pet owners who say, I don't want to do either of those vaccines. Can we get away with the nosodes and natural exposure? And the answer is a strong yes. In fact, the work that came out of a partner of mine, or not a partner, but a colleague of mine out of the East Coast showed really high titers, physical antibody measurable titers, to early on distemper when she had her puppy owners go out and visit a spot where the raccoons were all known to have distemper.
Oh, be darn.
And she'd set the pup down on the ground for 5 minutes, and, you know, the owner would, and then load him up, bring him home, go back a week later, set the pup on the ground to sniff around for 5 minutes, load up and go home. On the third week, they'd draw some blood, and she ended up doing it 3 weeks in a row and then drawing blood on the fourth in the end. But the titer, meaning the antibody, rose dramatically, saying, we have now made a response to that distemper virus without ever a moment of sickness. And these guys were now literally immune for life. But once you get that virus triggering a reaction in your own body naturally through a normal route, through an injection, you've got a great immunity. So she learned she could do that with parvo as well if they went to a dog park. And that's what's in this article.
That's great.
Takes off from her work.
That's on vitalanimal.com. And you can just Google parvo. Or not Google, but put parvo in your search engine, right?
Yeah.
So I know that you just finished up. I have a lot of questions here. Which the whole, you did a thing with Ty Bollinger on the cancer that we were going to talk about, what we missed because last week it didn't happen. Just overall, big picture, is that whole Ty Bollinger thing about truth about pet cancer still available to people? Can they see that? Or
it's not now.
But it's going to be, right?
Well, it'll probably come out again maybe in a year or so. But it was showing for free for a week. And then they had a replay weekend where they had all the 7 episodes available. That was last weekend. And then it's gone back in the vault for a while now.
I see.
But the group who put it on, Ty is one of these guys who's really kind of nonstop, and he's really dedicated to getting the word out. So he's made The Truth About Vaccines, which was just outstanding. He's done, the original one was The Truth About Cancer, which was focused on us humans.
Yeah.
And I'm sure those and more will be coming from he and his group. He's that kind of a guy.
Yeah. So we're back live now. Sorry about our internet just plopped off for the last half hour. We're talking with Dr. William Faulkner. If you pick up the live show, you'll have the complete podcast probably by noon today. Patrick@oneradionetwork.com is the email. So just big picture, since we can't see there for a while, are the vaccines an integral part, Dr. Faulkner, in your opinion, with the cancer in dogs, which is, it's pretty prolific, isn't it, out there?
Yeah, we're now up to, the current data shows that the odds of a dog getting cancer are 1 in 1.65 dogs.
That's just crazy.
It is crazy. It wasn't that way 50 years ago even, you know, as recently as 50 years ago, it was 1 in, you know, 100 or so. So, yeah, it's a man-made disease.
Yeah.
Vaccines do play a big role. They cause what I've just handily called immune confusion. You know, if you don't have an immune system that's on the alert properly, responding to things like allergens and tumor cells that we all have arise in us from time to time, then you increase your odds that you're going to have one of these cancer cells turn into a tumor and the tumor turn into a malignancy. So, yeah, it's been known for at least 150 years that the early homeopaths saw the correlation between vaccines and tumors. And we've seen it a lot. You know, the most striking one recently got a name change. They'd pick up the scruff of the neck to give a vaccine commonly, and where the cats got it,
yeah,
they get a tumor, and the tumor would turn into the size of a softball or bigger, and
yes,
they'd go under surgery and take it away, and it would come back, and the cats ended up succumbing to the cancer in the end. Well, for the longest time, they called that feline vaccine-associated sarcoma, VAS. And I just happened in the literature a little while ago, and now they've completely taken the V word out of it, you know, and they're calling it probably feline fibrosarcoma or something. And yet in the early days of naming it, they came right straight down on the word vaccine associated, because they knew it was. The rabies vaccine and the feline leukemia vaccine were the culprits. So it's still caused by that, but they just handily kind of swept that part under the carpet.
I had a kitty about 10 years ago that we got as a stray, and that's exactly what happened. She's about 12 or so. This tumor just start, you know, at the neck, you know, and just,
yeah,
just got huge, you know, just got huge.
Yeah.
So that's what that's about. That's what that's about.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And God bless them. You know, the Veterinary Association, the big organization, they just don't see it, or they don't get it, or they don't want to hear it.
Well,
or, you know,
it's not the associations as much as the individual practitioners. The associations came out, they were slow about it, but they came out and said, you know, we really shouldn't be vaccinating every year, which is what a lot of my profession was doing. And that's AHA, the American Animal Hospital Association, and that's the AVMA, the American Veterinary Medical Association, and several certifying bodies for, like feline practitioners and et cetera, all came out around, well, it's probably 15, almost 20 years ago, and said, we think this should be spread out. The veterinary schools were saying it. It was all over the press. Well, come to find out, just the last few years, something like 60% of my colleagues are still annually pushing vaccines on their patients. Why is that? Well, were they burying their head in the sand when everyone else is reading about we should push this out to every three? No, I don't think they could have missed it. You had to have lived under a rock to miss all that recommendation. It was profit motivated, you know? So it's like, where do we decide to draw the line and say, yeah, I've got to make a living, but I've got patients to protect, you know?
Sure, yeah.
So start doing titers if you want to, you know, make some money annually. I don't recommend this necessarily, but some vets have gone to saying, we're not going to vaccinate for the next couple of years, but come on in, we'll get a titer test drawn, meaning they'll pull some blood and see if there's antibodies left.
And so a titer is just taking some blood, which is harmless, and then it tells you the antibodies for whatever it is, parvo or even rabies too, right? So someday we could probably get, I know we had a Dr. Jody on, a really cool vet. I think she's out of Arizona. She's really been trying to push to get this whole titer thing going for rabies, so you don't have to give these rabies shots. Boy, that'd be a nice thing to do, wouldn't it? You could just say, well, look, my dog is immune, right? So this is viable. I mean, this is, it's real, these titers.
Yes, very, very real, very measurable, and very recognized, but not yet by the governing bodies who have these, I always put quotes around it, these laws about rabies. So these laws are not based on science. They're totally based on greed. And there's no reason on earth that a dog should have to be revaccinated at 3 years for rabies, or even worse, at 1 year for rabies. But these governing bodies found it was a way to license and profit and that sort of thing. So the history of how rabies laws started is really a rather dark one.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't based on epidemics running wild. And, you know, one guy used the FOIA Act to get his county's beginnings of the rabies law in his world. And there was no big epidemic sweeping his county. And a few vets and a governing official got together and said, let's make a rabies law. And, you know, that's probably happened in more cases than one.
Yeah. I heard on the radio, I live outside the Austin area, as you know, and I heard that there was a bat that they found with the rabies. So is that a danger to dogs who don't have the immune, the titer kind of thing? I mean, they could contract that if they came in contact with this, like a skunk or, you know, whatever, a bat or something, or a raccoon?
Yeah, it is a contagious disease, and it's resident in certain wildlife species. So in Texas, our main wildlife species are the bat, number one, and I think number two is probably the coyote, and the raccoon might be vying for number two. So the question is, do you want some protection at some point? And most people, unless they live in a high-rise apartment and the animal is never going to contract or never going to, you know, come across paths with one of these wildlife species, most people will want to do some protection. So what we've learned is that after the age of 4 months, if you give a couple of these rabies vaccines, probably about a month apart, the odds of you having lifetime immunity are very high. So I'll recommend that to people, especially in Texas, because our whole state is under quarantine for rabies because the incidence just kind of refuses to drop. We've got these wildlife vectors that we haven't been able to get under control. But it depends entirely on the situation. So again, if your animal lives in your purse and you know, goes shopping with you in the shopping cart and never gets feet on the pavement, I don't think that animal needs a rabies shot. But if you're living out in the North 40 and, you know, coyotes come across your land and you find a skunk wandering in the middle of the day, you'd feel a lot safer if you had some rabies protection. And I wish it were simpler. People ask me regularly, well, what about giving a nosode for rabies?
Yeah, like homeoprophylaxis, right?
Yeah, yeah. So the reason that doesn't work very well is that nosodes, while they do confer immunity, it's very short-lived immunity, meaning if you were exposed to, or if you knew rabies exposure was going to happen this week and you took the nosode or gave your dog the nosode, your dog had probably fended off pretty well, but you never know that. So then do you recommend taking a nosode every week for life? No, that's not good medicine. You know, you wouldn't keep giving a homeopathic remedy over and over and over to somebody, no matter what it was. So we can't say, well, I do nosodes yearly, and therefore my dog's protected. No, it's really not. That's one of the biggest mistakes I see out there, and it's something I teach in one of my courses on no-sos. Their window of protection is probably 5 days long, maybe a week, like that.
Wow.
So when I'm protecting puppies against parvo, I'm having them give it twice a week, and on the opposite week, distemper, twice a week, just in case they're getting exposed while they're young. But when they reach the age of 9 months, the risk of exposure is pretty much over. They already contacted it. They've made an immune response. Their immune system is strong and mature. That's not the case with rabies. They're the only way to get a natural exposure or any exposure to rabies is to get a bite from a rabid animal. It's transmitted by saliva. It's not a respiratory thing, you know, like distemper. It's not a stool to oral transmission like parvo. So needless to say, you don't get a natural exposure by a bite and hope for the best, right? It's a little bit riskier in that sense. And what else, you know, takes it into a whole nother level is it's a human disease. So we've got that wrinkle of humans can get rabies from their dog who got rabies from the skunk. So that's why there's laws at all about it. That's why there's regulations at all about it.
Doc, we are getting some really bad sound on this VOIP thing on you. Just really not happy. Let me do this. We're going to pick up on the rabies. Since we're back live, I'm going to do a quick little commercial here, and we will pick up on Skype, okay?
Okay.
I'm
going to
call
sure.
you on Skype. Okay, yeah, that sound, you heard that, boy. The VOIP things can be a challenge where they just, let me fix this here a second, and they just are not happy. I'm going to call them back, and then we're going to pick up on Skype. Sorry about the internet outage this morning. It was just one of those crazy things. 888-663-6386. We're going to get your emails with Dr. Will Faulkner. So thanks for your patience on that, but you can hear the whole podcast, the first half hour, if you're back with us live. Previously with Daniel Vitalis, we were talking about, pine pollen.
Pollen is essentially the equivalent of what an animal would have as sperm. Pollen is like the male part, the semen, and it fertilizes the ovum of the flower, which becomes eventually a fruit. And so if we were going to draw the equivalence, it would be like that the flower is like the female sex organ and the pollen is like the male sexual ejaculate. Well, pine trees, which sort of just dominate so much of the landscape of North America and so much of the world, pine trees, their semen, they dust the landscape in pollen. And that pollen, being the sort of male part of the plant, has some correspondences to male physiology in our species and many other animal species. So what I'm saying is pine pollen contains all of these different anabolic or androgenic hormones, plant versions of hormones that we need, like testosterone, like DHEA.
Well, the birds and the bees and the flowers and the trees, good stuff, guys, and for you girls, too. Several choices of pine pollen. Any Surthrival link, oneradionetwork.com. And speaking of Surthrival, there's we are, the colostrum, which is a really great little food. It's on sale, big sales on any Surthrival link, colostrum, the 1 and 2 kilo packages. For those of you who didn't homeschool, a kilo is 2.2 pounds. We always like to take care of you if you went to public school. Just kidding. And 4.4 pounds. And it's really a great product. And you can mix it up with some ghee and chocolate and make a little mousse. And, you know, you just do all kinds of fun things like that. And that is pine or colostrum on sale now with Surthrival. Previously with Stephanie Seneff, PhD, research scientist with MIT on her work with glyphosates, GMO, and sulfur.
I know you really care about sulfur, and so do I. You know, I really think sulfur is crucial for health, and that we have a massive problem with sulfur deficiency in this country. One of the proteins that I found that is disrupted by glyphosate, because it has an essential glycine, is sulfotransferase. That's a protein that moves sulfate from one molecule to another, but it's really, really important to be able to do that.
And why wouldn't it be able to do it? Because the glyphosate disrupts the natural sulfur cycle in our body?
The cell won't be able to defend itself with sulfate if it can't put the sulfate there. And of course, glyphosate chelates sulfur.
A perfect storm in the challenges department, perhaps, but we're getting creative. So we know that we've been low on sulfur for years because of the chemical fertilizers, and now the GMO thing, which is disrupting the sulfur cycle. And we know with sufficient amounts of sulfur in the body, it's the natural way that the body gets these heavy metals, for example, mercury and mercury sulfate, out of the body, if we have enough sulfur. Click and order sulfur today on OneRadioNetwork.com. And a lot of folks like to get more than 4 pounds, and they share it with family and friends, and they really have some good experiences with knees, creaky knees and stuff like that, and remembering more of their dreams. It's kind of a fun thing. You can just email me, and we'll work it out with you. And that's Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. It's April 19th, 2018. We are live now with Dr. Will Faulkner. Thanks to the internet guys, they got us back up after only about half an hour off. His website is vitalanimal.com. We are talking about the rabies. So to recap, in general, you like to just go ahead and give the regular rabies vaccine one or two times and then work on the immunity ongoing and check the titers. Is that a big picture like Dr. Faulkner you like to do?
Yeah, that's pretty much the big picture for most people. The exception is if you live in a place, and I have students all over the world, so I say, you know, you can check the rabies incidence in your area. If you've got listeners in, you know, outside of Texas, sure, their rabies incidence in wildlife is going to be way lower than ours is, just because of where we live in relation to Mexico, et cetera. So you can go on the CDC website and look up your county. It can get that narrow, and you can see the incidence of rabies in wildlife and domestic animals over the last, usually a couple decades or more. So if someone's living, like I've got a student in Ontario, and she said, well, you know, I'm worried about rabies. They're saying I should vaccinate for it. So we went up and looked up her Toronto area, and looking at the whole province of Ontario, you can see there are some loci of rabies, but it was nowhere near where she lived, you know, just miles and miles away. So I said, you know, unless you're going to troop up to these places and walk in the woods, I don't think you've got any real serious risk of rabies. And she said, well, thanks. I feel a whole lot better, you know, seeing it's a weighing of risk versus benefit.
Sure.
So I don't take even a single rabies vaccine lightly, because I've seen a single rabies vaccine be the undoing of several of my patients. And people write me all the time and saying my dog was fine until he got a rabies shot. And then, you know, it started seizing or started behaving badly, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a decision made best individually with the most information you can get. And one of the things I'm coming up with next month is a course I put together on just this question on rabies.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Because and folks can go to vitalanimal.com and sign up for that course. And what's that going to be called? Do you have a specific name?
Yeah, it's called Rabies: Knowledge is Power.
Okay.
So the smarter you get about this, the better off you'll be. And it's not yet up on my website, but if you search out courses, you'll find a place. There's a search box on every article. If you just search out courses, you'll find a place where you can at least get on the wait list and be the first to hear about it when it comes out. But I can't tell you how rabies and the law about it is the number one concern on most pet owners' minds. You know, they're writing me day in and day out saying, well, where I live, we have a law about it.
Yeah.
And I'll say, yeah, well, you and 48 other states all have a law about it. So it's not just where you live.
And when do you think the course will be happening soon?
Yeah, it'll be in May for sure. I don't have a date yet, but probably second or third week in May.
Oh, that's great. So just go to vitalanimal.com and to courses, and you'll see rabies, a course, and rabies knowledge is power, and you can sign up. So do you do, is that like a webinar thing? And Over one or two sessions? How does that work?
Yeah, there's actually three sessions. I made it with a bunch of students who joined my Natural Rearing Roadmap course. And so I took a poll among all my readers, which are now up in the multi-thousands. And I said, tell me your top two questions about rabies. And I held live Zoom meetings with these students who all got this the chance to be on this course with me. And so we had both a presentation at the beginning about what the disease is and what's the current state of control and where it's a risk and where it isn't. And then the third part was about strategies to help you kind of find your way through and around this law if you know that you've got an immune animal or you've got an animal whose risk of getting more rabies vaccines is far greater than the risk of getting rabies itself.
Mm-hmm.
So now, it's a really, go ahead. It's an in-depth course. Yeah.
So homeoprophylaxis and nosodes, are they one and the same?
Yeah, they are pretty interchangeable.
Now, we've done shows, Dr. Faulkner, with folks in Australia about people in homeoprophylaxis, but they claim that you can look at the stats and see at least better, even better protection from the homeoprophylaxis in humans with less downside. But is it different? It must be different where the animals don't take it for a long time.
Have I lost you?
No. I'm here. I'm here. Hello, testing 1, 2. I'm here.
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah, you cut out for a moment.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, my thing seems stable. So on the homeoprophylaxis...
I'm here, Patrick. I don't know if you can hear me.
Yeah, I can hear you. Can you hear me? Hello. Yeah, my internet seems okay right now. How about yours?
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I'm hearing you again now.
Okay. Well, it's just got something going on. So the homeoprophylaxis in people evidently is even better than the regular vaccines, according to these people in Australia and the work that's been going on around the world. But it's different in dogs. Different.
Not that different. I think also I misspoke a moment ago. Homeoprophylaxis predates nosodes. So the earliest work on it was done by Samuel Hahnemann, who founded homeopathy a couple hundred years ago. He was an MD, a brilliant MD, who was one of the true scientists who observed things and then came to conclusions after careful work to verify what he had as a theory of why this worked or why this happened this way.
Mm-hmm.
He found in his early work that he could go into a household with scarlet fever and found that the remedy of the day that cured the cases was belladonna. And if he gave belladonna, which is just a normal remedy, it's not a nosode, it's a remedy made from a plant.
Mm-hmm.
If he gave that belladonna to the kids in the house who hadn't yet contracted the scarlet fever, they did not get it. So that was the earliest work on homeoprophylaxis. And that was very much homeopathy, which is using a similar substance as opposed to the same substance. So nosodes are really kind of an offshoot of that, that say if we're fighting lepto like they did in Cuba or Haiti, where the huge study was done and your Australian friends know well about, they made a remedy from lepto itself, from someone who was sick with lepto. And in our case with distemper or parvo, the pharmacies make for us a remedy from the discharges of parvo or the discharges of an animal sick with distemper. And that's more like isopathy. It's a fine point, but it's giving the same thing to someone we want to prevent the disease in. And I think we get very similar results in all species. We get a strong immunity, but it's not even the homeoprophylaxis proponents will tell you that it's not a long-lasting immunity. In other words, we're not creating antibody titers or memory cells like a vaccine does. We're creating a momentary relative immunity to something that's coming at us right now. So the most striking data on that was the lepto study out of Haiti, back when a hurricane went through and they had no power and they had flooding. And when flooding comes, lepto is the scourge of the weather, and it gets into people and it causes acute illness, real serious illness, fairly good death rate.
Uh-huh.
So they lined people up and said, we're going to give you these nosodes. And they had some homeopaths who were making them as fast as they could hand them out, and it didn't cost anything. And they turned this epidemic around, and it was well researched and lots of data on it. They were talking in the hundreds of thousands of people, if not over a million.
So it's effective in humans, but it's not something like, in theory, the vaccines where once you do it, well, then you're good your whole life. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true in all species.
In all species, yeah. Huh?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, let's take a few emails here. So just to recap on the itching, which is your number one thing, itching's you think most likely connected to vaccines. And if you're diligent, you could oftentimes find a vaccine that will get rid of this or a homeopathic that'll get rid of this vaccine damage in the body?
Well, not a remedy. Here's where it gets complicated. Okay. So these vaccines confer a state of chronic disease. And whether we call that vaccinosis or we call it allergy, it's kind of just a matter of terms. Chronic disease can be cured with homeopathy, but it's never easy work. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's not finding that one golden remedy that's going to be the key that unlocks the padlock. So the reason I teach natural rearing in the main course that I offer periodically is to get people out of that mode of prevention that causes the damage, get them naturally immune, help them avoid vaccines or absolutely minimize vaccines, and get them to where they're not going to get allergies in the first place. Because when they've got them, there aren't good answers. There's drugs that suppress symptoms, and there's homeopathy that takes, depending on the amount of time the allergy's been there, about half the amount of time to get them cured. So if somebody brings me a dog who's been itchy for 2 years, I say, we're going to be working together for a year, and it's going to take more than one remedy. It's going to take paying a lot of attention to what the symptoms are doing, and we're going to be on the phone about monthly or so.
Wow.
Until we get this turned around.
Wow. So and so it's just not an easy thing because of this whole vaccine paradigm that many of us got into and didn't even know. We didn't know.
Correct.
Wow.
Yeah.
Man, it's really interesting. Are your colleagues who are working like you do having similar experiences as far as timing and the amount of focus, doc, and attention that has to go into to really turning a vaccine thing around?
Yeah, they are. And they're coming at it at different fronts. The homeopaths among us who I'll meet with in October at our annual meeting, we're all, you know, struggling to cure the patients, you know, and it's being in the trenches and it's doing the hard work of figuring out each case as an individual.
Yeah.
There's no one size fits all in homeopathy, never has been. But I've also got a colleague named John Robb, who some of your readers will have run into, who's trying to change the laws.
Yeah.
And he's got an outfit he's calling Protect the Pets, or PTP, I guess. Yeah, PTP. And so those people who want to take effort on the legislative level should look him up online. He's on Facebook, John Robb DVM, and come at it from that road, because ultimately what I'm teaching is, if you live in a state where they're not going to notice and you've got an immune dog, just quietly drop out, because you've done the work, you've fulfilled the intent of the law, but following the letter of the law, meaning getting your animal revaccinated and revaccinated and revaccinated because the law says so, you're putting your animal at risk, and no benefit comes from that. If they're already immune and you vaccinate again, you don't add to that immunity. That's what the immunologists tell us. You're just both wasting money and risking your dog's health. So Dr. Robb is coming at it from saying, well, let's work on changing the law. And I'm one of the few voices apparently who's saying, if you've already done your due diligence and have an immune animal, and you can check that with a titer, then just kind of quietly drop off the radar if you can.
Yeah.
You know, depends where you live.
Seems like the reasonable thing to do. Dr. Will Faulkner, vitalanimal.com, he's got a course coming up on the whole rabies thing in next month, and you can go on there and sign up and get on that. We have a question from Jack, and he's got an 8-year-old opso with rides in a vehicle, and he just gets really nervous and shaking, panting, tried the thunder jacket chamomile tea blankets to cover him, but he just really doesn't like it at all. Are there any thoughts for dog supplementations for relaxing the doggy?
Yeah. It's not so much relaxing. It's finding the remedy that helps, and maybe training as well, but finding the combination of remedy that fits the dog and training that kind of desensitizes. So trainers who are smart will say, you know, we're going to make this car a really fun place to be, and we're going to have several journeys to the car where it's just you and I going in the car with a treat. And so the dog's associating the car with something good happening. It's not a scary trip to the vet every time we do it, or it's not motion and, you know, 60 miles an hour and things whizzing by us. That's a scary thing to a dog who's ground-based. So the combination of the two, working with a homeopath and getting, you know, there'll be a couple other symptoms when you talk to a homeopathic vet that typically come out in a history, will help find the remedy that helps kind of unwind the fearfulness. There might be fearfulness also of thunder and fearfulness also of, you know, a backfire of a car that just kind of unglues this dog. But counter conditioning or just kind of shaping the behavior by saying, you know, car's a really fun place to go. Where will you get this treat? Huh. You know, that'll get it turned around. A remedy that's worth a look-see is one called phosphorus. And it may or may not be the one that cures this dog of the phobia of traveling in cars. But if you go online and read about homeopathic phosphorus, you might find enough symptoms that say, yeah, that's similar. And then you could find it at Whole Foods, for instance, and give some phosphorus before a car trip and see if it works. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't, it's not the right remedy. It won't do any harm, but it needs to be searched out further, usually with the help of somebody who's trained.
We have heartworms and fleas time again, right? Both?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So these heartworm preventatives, they're toxins, aren't they? I mean, the ones you get at the vet?
Yeah, they definitely are. They work by paralyzing the worm. So they're neurotoxins.
Wow.
And so are the classes of flea and tick killers. You know, they're the word used is commonly preventatives, but really what they are is poisons.
Those are the ones they want you to put them on the neck and all that, and you rub them in there every 30 days. What do they call those, the famous ones?
Oh, they're frontline.
Frontline and all those things.
Yeah.
But they're doing, are they dangerous to take?
Yeah, they are. I mean, the basic question should be, you know, in everybody's mind, and we tend to forget it in the glaze of marketing, that marketing tends to cast a spell on us, right? We should ask a real basic question, which is, if something kills pests, wouldn't you call that a pesticide? Well, yeah, that's the definition of a pesticide. It's something that kills pests. And then the next logical question would be, is my dog or cat or horse going to be healthier or less healthier if I give them a pesticide, right? Does that improve their health to give them a pesticide?
Yeah.
And when you look at it like that, it's the obvious answer is, well, no, of course not. That's not going to improve their health. They're not pesticide deficient, you know. So the one that really scares me now, is it okay to use a brand name?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. There's one that came out maybe probably a year ago called Bravecto, B-R-A-V-E-C-T-O. Bravecto is a pill that kills fleas and ticks and maybe some third thing. And the instructions say, give it to your dog. And it starts killing fleas within 2 hours, I believe, is the magic figure. And it lasts up till 12 weeks. Well, so, okay, imagine yourself in a scenario of going to the doctor saying, you know, doc, these mosquitoes are really bugging me. He says, oh, I've got a great answer for you. Just take this pill once every 3 months. And if a mosquito bites you and drinks your blood, he'll die. Well, would you take it? You know, it's like, come on, let's think through this here. If we're killing the fleas via your dog's blood, how can that help your dog be healthier? You know, it's asking the pesticide to be transported by the blood, and it lasts for 12 weeks, one pill. So yeah, we're seeing all sorts. I've got a post on it in my articles section on my blog, and the emails that come in are just scary. You know, my dog took this thing once and I lost him. You know, he was a 6-year-old and he died, you know, a month later. Or I gave this to my dog and he had seizures afterwards. And, you know, so you see enough of these things and you go, well, how long did they study the thing? Well, guess who studied it and who published the research? It's the marketer who owns the drug. And they studied it in laboratory beagles, and they studied it for maybe 8 or 12 weeks. You know, no one studied it for 4 years. You know, so no one studied it for a year. And it's just kind of common sense becoming less common, I'm afraid, where we think, oh, this is what I need because the vet's recommending it, and it kills things, and you know, my dog's going to be way better because he's not fighting fleas. Well, yeah, but how about your dog's own health, right?
Yeah. Yeah, same thing's going on with people's, right, Doc? It's the same thing. God love us.
It is.
You believe the docs, and they think they're doing the right thing because somebody tells them, and it's just...
Exactly. And unfortunately, I remember all too well in the days of conventional practice.
You were there, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I was there for 7 years. We really did get our information largely from the drug reps.
Yeah. Wow.
They'd come in with something new and say, here's the data we're showing, and they'd leave us a ream of information, which we didn't have time to read. We just took their word for it, you know? So, yeah, well, send us a case, you know? So, unfortunately, that's all too common. We're busy in practice. We don't have time to do the research, and so we tend to believe the drug reps, and they're in it for one thing. They're in it to sell you the drugs.
Patrick talks a lot about genetically modified foods and has Dr. Stephanie Seneff on, and he plays a commercial. This is from Jason. He's in Omaha. What does Dr. Faulkner feel the challenge is with dogs and cats in genetically modified foods?
It's a really big one, just like it is in people. So the trouble is if we're feeding foods that came from genetically modified animals, right? We're feeding a carnivore beef or beef byproducts, and that cow before slaughter was eating a ton of corn, which was all GMO, or soybean, which is largely all GMO. That's going to translate to illness in the pet, and we've seen it. In fact, some of the early work shows that animals given a choice, if they had a GMO choice of feed and a non-GMO choice of feed, they would never touch the GMO source of feed. They would avoid it. And so they instinctually know that it's a problem. But if they've got nothing else to eat, and that's what's in the food dish, they've got to eat it. And it's toxic. It causes gut disturbances at the very least. Glyphosate, as you well know, kills normal flora, and everybody and their brother and their dog and their cat all need healthy flora to have a healthy immune system, to digest well, to, you know, manufacture some of the B vitamins, et cetera, just a whole wealth of the longer we get into this, the more we see, you know, we really depend on a healthy gut flora to do so much for us. So yeah, it's a big issue.
Yeah.
And we can trust probably the organic sources. And I'm telling people who are interested in raw feeding to find a local source of somebody who's grass feeding their animals, you know,
and
give those guys your dollars. Don't give your dollars to Science Diet and the guys who don't care about quality, you know?
Yeah. And it's not very easy to find a good reputable company with a kibble or any other kind of food that's totally, absolutely organic. It's not a lot out there, you know. There are a few choices,
but it's tough.
We know a doc up in New York area, Dr. Broderick. Do you know Dr. Broderick?
No, I haven't met him.
Oh, yeah, you should check out his website called Cornucopia Foods, and we've had him on the show. And he has a can now. Of course, we think that raw is better, but he has a can product with meat. And it's totally, absolutely organic. It's just So for convenience, if you're traveling or you want to supplement, really, really nice Cornucopia Pet Foods. Absolutely organic. Just people-grade food. He eats some of the food himself out of every batch, just to make sure. It's pretty cool stuff. So there's not a lot out there. I mean, Origin, which is touted to be a really nice kibble, I mean, that's not really organic, is it? I mean, they have a lot of wild things, but you don't know some of those things in there, do you?
Yeah, you don't. It's tough to know. And even some of the raw diets, I've got a report I've sent out at various times called the HPP and Raw Food Report, which is here you've got raw food and you're feeding it because you want it to, you know, have all those enzymes intact and be species appropriate. And yet these foods have undergone HPP, which is high pressure pasteurization. Oh. So it means they've got under more pressure than you'd find down at the bottom of the Mariana Trench, which is the deepest spot in the ocean. It's enough to crush a submersible to a, you know, if they had a leak. And so these foods are really not raw, and yet they don't have to say HPP on their label. I had a researcher helping me uncover the brands that were and the ones that still weren't. But they're getting so many recalls now, these small pet food manufacturers who are trying to make the right raw food product. And the FDA is just jumping on them if they have, you know, E. coli or Salmonella found. Well, we find that in bags of commercial kibble, and we find it in, you know, regular commercial pet food. So these guys are being unnecessarily singled out. It doesn't make the dog sick, but it potentially could make a human sick if they ate the food or if they got too close to the stools that came out from the dog who was never sick but passed Salmonella. Yeah. So, you know, it's buyer beware, as you well know.
Boy, you got to be careful, don't you? Really got to be careful. And just a little thing too, you know, a lot of people advertise grass-fed, and unless it's grass-fed and grass-finished, they could they could spend the last 2 months of their life on GMO corn.
Exactly.
And you don't know. It's like, wow, man. Yeah. It's like, whoa. Yeah, yeah. It's like, come on.
Okay. Some of the dairy that's sold as organic dairy, there's a lot of work being done. Again, the word cornucopia comes out of Wisconsin. There's a group called Cornucopia that's like a watchdog for organics in our world.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
they're saying some of these dairies who are claiming organic status have tens of thousands of cows, and there's no way that those animals are living out on grass more than a very small fraction of their lives. They're in the analogous CAFO sort of a situation, concentrated animal feeding outfit, or whatever O stands for, operation, I think.
Yeah.
And it's illegal to fly over these guys and take pictures. They've got some on the Cornucopia site, but you can see there's a few cows out on dirt. You know, they're not eating grass, and they're probably spending most of their days in the barn. And yet they can market a milk that's called organic milk, and you get this happy feeling when you drink it, and you know, that these cows were living the good life, and they weren't.
I love them. Yeah, we'll put that link. I know that website. We'll put that link on the show here along with your link, vitalanimal.com. We are so blessed, though. I mean, and I'm sure there are other farmers markets around the country doing this, but even in Dripping Springs, you can get eggs where they actually show you the label of the feed that they supplement with that's organic and no soy and no GMO stuff. I mean, so there are people that are interested, you know, in this stuff. So if you look around, it's there. I suspect farmers markets around the country are doing this.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's the encouraging thing is we do have smart people and we do have people who care. And you know, the big marketers are probably noticing this, and if they are smart, they're going to shift their deal as well. You know, the demand is there. Let's put it that way.
Alex has a chocolate lab. Izzy. She said, unfortunately, before I knew, I did have vaccinated her when she was younger. I did a lot of other awful things too, like heartworm meds and flea protection, all before I learned what was really going on. And now Izzy eats totally organic grass-fed meats and things like that, spend a lot of money on it. She says, but she's developed these cysts between her toes, all four paws. Wow, I think they are called interdigital F-R-F-U-R-U-N-C-L-E-S. They grow and then they burst and they bleed occasionally, and her paws are way more sensitive than normal, kind of like a toe fungus or something. And I like to, sometimes I soak her feet in solutions of water, peroxide, and vinegar, but that seems to help. But she's out there. The vet wants to give her antibiotics. She does get into some local ponds and lakes when they go camping. I wanted to know if you had some ideas about what this could be or what she could do for these little things in the paws. Wow.
Yeah, Alex, it's unfortunate. And what it is proliferative tissue. So it's what homeopaths have recognized as being associated with the vaccines, which is we tend to get growthy when we've had vaccines. And growthy can be anything from warts to bumps to these things between the toes, all the way on the far end of growthy to malignant tumors. So it's man-made, it's created, it's chronic disease, meaning like you've experienced already, it's not just, you know, got into something and we wash it away and it goes away. Mm-hmm. You're having to continually try to do something. So the best answer, albeit not the simplest and do-it-yourself answer, is to get a homeopathic vet hired to help you cure it, because it's going to take some time. It's going to take more than one remedy, one given at a time, very carefully and evaluated, that sort of thing. But applause to you for doing the raw food that's healthy. That's a huge step in the right direction. But what I've seen over and over again is there's a certain percentage of animals who have just been damaged enough that won't fix them. You know, there's a pretty big percentage of animals who are allergic to things, and they get them off the kibble and onto a balanced raw diet, meaning meat and bone and organ and that sort of thing in a good balance, and they'll clear up their itch. But there's that certain segment that says, yeah, that helped, Mom, but I really still need something else. And that's where homeopathy shines, like no other medicine I know. They don't get better with drugs. God help them. The vets, back when I started becoming a holistic vet 20, 30 years ago, they were doing surgery on these feet and sewing the webbing together so there was no space for these things to grow. Well, talk about a medieval procedure to try to cure a chronic disease. That didn't cure anything. That just took away the space where the proliferation was trying to make its way out to the surface. So conventional medicine won't have any answers for you, but homeopathy will. It just takes hiring a professional who does it most or all of the time.
Is there, obviously you're available, but you're a very busy guy, vitalanimal.com. Is there a central source for, we have listeners all over the world, really.
Sure, sure.
To find a homeopathic vet?
Yeah, you can do a search. There's a Academy of Veterinary Homeopathy, AVH for short.
Okay.
And their website, I think, is theAVH, theavh.org. And that, at least for North America, will help you find a list of vets geographically. But the key is you don't necessarily need someone close to you. You can work by telephone, and the search mechanism in that website lets you search on a couple of variables that I think are important. One, you want somebody who's fully into the homeopathic method. So I would search for people who are doing 75% or more homeopathy, and they're broken down that way. You don't want somebody who's just kind of doing it on the weekends and most of the time they're suppressing disease. So look for somebody who's doing it mostly or only. And two, search for someone who's doing it by phone, because there aren't enough of us to go around, unfortunately. We're not in every town or, you know, certainly in every city. I wish we were. But you'll pull up a group of people that way, and you can interview them and just, you know, give them a call and say, you know, I've got this dog with this chronic disease, and I know it's going to take time. If it's been there for a year, I know I'm looking at 6 months probably to get this dog well, but I want to work with you. And then just see how it feels. You could interview a couple and, you know, see how they work and But that'll get the answer. That'll get the animal fixed. Whereas nothing topical will, certainly nothing from conventional medicine will.
Yeah. We have John, a few more, then we'll let you go. John in Seattle, are there any shampoos that Dr. Faulkner has come across that certainly are not going to cure anything, but that really help with the itchiness, which I have going on with my golden retriever? A lot of itchies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's just so everyone knows, that is the number one reason that dogs see vets, and it's been true for over a decade. We've got data on that.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's nothing, John, that'll really succumb to a topical treatment. You know, if you find that getting even a cold hose over the dog buys you several hours of relief, then do that. But shampoos can dry out the skin, which can make a itch worse. So I don't generally push shampoos of any kind more than maybe once a week if the dog is really smelling bad. They'll often smell bad when they've got itchy skin. They're pushing out toxins and that sort of thing. So I would focus not so much topically as making sure you've left kibble behind and you've gotten on, like we were talking earlier, on a good balanced raw diet, ideally with some local sources of, you know, good, truly grass-fed animals. And see, likely you'll get ahead of about 70% of that itch by doing that alone.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. That's
great. Here's Linda. She is in Cincinnati. We're thinking about getting a puppy, our long-lost little dachshund passed last year, but we're ready to do it again, some puppy. But after all these things that I read about and hear on Patrick's show, I just don't know where to go to find a puppy that give me the best chance at a healthy life. Does Dr. Faulkner have some theories and some ideas on what to do? Well, that's a great question. Puppyless in Seattle, in Cincinnati, but they're saying, okay, now, where do I find a little one that's giving me my best shot at a happy life? That's interesting.
Yeah. It's a great question. I've got a report free, Linda, that I'll send you. You just write me via my website. There's a contact page on my website.
Oh, great.
We took stock of people who call themselves natural rearing breeders. And like anything else, it's a self-identified label, but we really went to the ropes with them and said, tell me what that means for you. We want somebody who's been raising generations naturally without vaccines in the parents, without vaccines in the youngsters, without poisons, and with a good raw diet. And we found a handful of them and put them on a report that I'll be happy to send to you. And that's the best place to start. That was one of the things that we put in my Natural Rearing Roadmap course, because we wanted people to have a source of animals who were raised right generationally. That's where it all starts. Because you can get inherited chronic disease in people and in animals. We can see what we got from our ancestors if we look a little.
Yeah.
Same is true in the animals.
Oh, can you... But if you got to really find a natural breeder outside of your town that you want, you say, boy, I'd like to get one of these. Do they fly them around? Do you probably could drive to them, right? Would be the best thing, wouldn't they? Drive to them, pick them up.
Yeah, it varies. I mean, some of them are, you know, in Canada and it's not maybe practical. But yeah, ideally, if you can do that. One of the things I tell people, too, is if you're dealing with a breeder, make sure that breeder is happy to let you come and tour their facility. If there's a red flag at all in buying a puppy, it's we're going to meet you at such and such a place and give you your puppy. That's a Z-class breeder. You don't want to have anything to do with them because they're embarrassed about their facility.
Yeah. This is a great question here, too. This is from Cricket in Abilene, Texas. God bless Abilene. We rescued an abandoned Shih Tzu, probably about 4. He was living down south at Laredo, fending for himself in 104-degree weather, killing birds, eating food from people, feeding scraps. I haven't taken him to the vet yet, and I don't want him to give him a lot of unneeded vaccinations. We have had him for about a year now, and he seems to be fine. Every now and then he throws up out of the blue, but that's about it. And do I need to have him checked out? And can the vet do a tighter test for the rabies and other tests? What would Dr. Faulkner recommend? Well, that's a good question, too. Everybody's doing fine. I mean, do we even need to go in and get them checked out?
If you're curious about health status, it never hurts to get diagnostic work done, including titers. So the words I tell people to say loud and clear to everybody from the janitor to the front office desk to the veterinarian is, we're only here for one reason, and that's to get diagnostic work done. We're here for a titer, we're here for maybe a blood profile, and let's get a stool check just to make sure there's no parasites. Uh-huh. That's totally not going to hurt anybody. It's when you're not real clear about that, that they can take your animal to the back and maybe give a shot that you didn't intend for that animal to have. So being real upfront with everybody and saying, I'm just here for this purpose, and repeat it and repeat it and stay with your dog, you should be fine. And I think it's a reasonable thing to ask for titers. Now, titers are still, many vets still plead ignorance on this. We don't know what a titer is, or they come up with a cockamamie thing of, well, a titer is just like a moment in time, and it doesn't really tell you what it's going to be tomorrow. They haven't studied it. They're blowing smoke when they say that, because a titer is a very solid thing, and it doesn't change from day to day. It's not like a thermometer or something that goes up and down. So if you get somebody who's kind of professing that titers are a bad idea, I would leave. I would not pay that person any money and go do a little phone shopping and find somebody who knows what they're talking about and says, yeah, I'll be happy to do a titer test for you. Mm-hmm. And it shouldn't be an expensive thing. Now they have in-house kits, and even if you send it off to Kansas State where they do the only rabies titers pretty much on North America, it shouldn't be more than, I think the latest was about $45 for the test, and they shouldn't charge you any more than, you know, a little bit to get the blood drawn. Hmm. So, yeah.
They have these little simple tests at some vets where they test for heartworms in about 20 minutes. Are those things accurate? Mm-hmm. Are they accurate?
Yeah, they're fairly accurate. They're up in the 90 percentile, I think.
Uh-huh. Regina is in Orlando, Florida. I'm thinking about getting my dog tested for different food allergies through blood tests. Does Dr. Faulkner have an opinion about the accuracy of these?
Yeah, it's a great question, Regina. I don't recommend them. What you end up finding is that they're allergic to a lot of things, and over time that list grows. And it's not, yeah.
Don't go out in the grass, don't eat eggs, don't do
exactly.
This.
Exactly.
Just like people.
Don't breathe,
right?
Yeah, don't hold your breath.
Yeah. Oh, gosh.
Yeah. So it's really silly. And a lot of these tests come back with just horrendous findings, like allergic to things that the dog would never have possibly have eaten, like lentils or, you know, some mousse or something, you know. Well, my dog's never, you know, eaten this stuff. And so I don't put stock in them. I think a lot of them are a lot of false positives and a lot of caution that really doesn't help you get what you're after, which is curing the allergic state. So we learned from experience back in the, I guess it was the 80s, that the great answer to the itchy dog was lamb and rice diets. They came out with lamb and rice as a kibble. And everybody went, oh, hooray, we've solved this problem. Well, then the other shoe dropped and they became allergic to lamb, or they became allergic to rice, or to both. So we didn't cure the state of allergy. We just gave them some breathing room for a while. And then they come out with the next exotic protein, and that's gone on for generations now. And they've got this thing called Z, I think is in the name of it, ZD maybe, from Hills or something. And what they've done is they've take these proteins from animals that they're going to use for feedstock, and they've tweaked these proteins, they've denatured these proteins, and then put them in the dog food. Some of them are even made from chicken feathers, and they took that off the label because that people were laughing at them. Very expensive diet, but it's a hydrolyzed protein, meaning it's been chemically treated and changed, and, you know, hopefully not going to trigger an allergy. What you want ultimately is cure, meaning they're not allergic to things, they're not overreactive to things, and that comes from careful work in homeopathy, to my knowledge. I don't know of anything else that does that well.
Back to this that we alluded to at the beginning, do you think then that the toxins and different things are a challenge to the gut of the dog, similar to people, where we try to heal the gut with old bone broth, colostrum, what are some other stuff, this Restore product that Zach Bush has out for people that seems to help, you know, tighten up the junctions, you know, and all that leaky gut thing. Is that going on in the animals, do we think, the gut?
I think it probably is, especially as prominent as antibiotics play a role in conventional medicine for animals like they do in people. Mm-hmm. We've got disruption going on down there. I'm just not sure how far it'll go, and I think the jury is still out on that. What some of my colleagues are doing, though, is fecal transplants, and they're finding phenomenal results with fecal transplants from a really healthy dog who's never had antibiotics into your dog rectally.
Yeah, they're doing that with people, too.
Yeah.
What do you think about this? This is a great question to end with, because this is a fun question. I mean, I go to the farmer's market, and half the dogs are half poodle. It's just hilarious. You go there, and then, you know, we got a Miami Poo, we got a Golden Doodle, and then we got a Labradoodle, and they're crossing poodles with everything. Do you think this is it's really like a big fad now, as you know. It's huge.
Yeah.
Do you think this is healthy? What do you think about this?
Well, I think breeders have to be really responsible and have to study genetics a bit to know when it's gone too far. So I met an Aussie Doodle a couple of weeks ago who was the sweetest dog I've ever met, smart as a whip, like Aussie, and mellow and steady like a standard poodle.
Yeah.
And so I said, well, this is a dog that's going to go places, you know. It's not just a look, it's a functional dog. The woman had it for a farm dog. So I think the possibility is there that unless a breeder is careful about avoiding too much inbreeding, that we'll have some disasters along those lines. But just bringing a poodle into another breed entirely, that's outcrossing. That's called hybridization, and that's a good thing.
Why is it a good thing? Why is it a good thing?
Well, we've known from genetics long, long ago on corn, of all things, that there's this thing called hybrid vigor.
Mm-hmm.
So if you mingle two quite different strains, the hybrid often has further better abilities to grow and to produce and to be healthy than either one had alone. So there's an additive effect. So I think in general it's not a dangerous thing. But then when you've got generation after generation of these animals, how close are you breeding? Are you breeding cousin to or mother to son? When you're starting out making a breed, you pretty much have to do that because there aren't relatives across the country who've done a similar thing. But the more people that get involved in this and the more responsible they are about tracking genetics, and breeders are by and large aware of this, unless it's just a backyard accident. I think the potential is there to cause some problems down the road.
But these are unknowns right now. We don't.
Yeah.
I mean, who would study this stuff? I mean, you'd have to. Yeah. It's like.
Whew, right. But a breeder who's doing their homework knows that they can get away with a certain amount of line breeding, which means the same stud dog breeds all the females. They can get away with that for a while, but then they've got to shift up and get a male who's unrelated to that male. And there's inbreeding, which is, you know, mother to son or that sort of thing. And you can get away with that for a certain amount of time, but they're tracking this usually if they're responsible breeders.
So people are going to go to a breeder, really question them about this whole line breeding and inbreeding. And you'll be able to tell, I guess, after a little while on the phone with them, whether they know what they're doing or not.
Well, you'd have to be pretty studied in genetics to ask the right questions. Yeah.
Okay. Do you do courses on that? Is that on your website, Vital Animal? You haven't got into that yet, huh?
No.
Well, I guess too, if you just have a poodle and the neighbor has a golden retriever, you could just do that too, like we did, and it comes out pretty good.
Yeah, I don't think you'll get in much trouble doing that.
Yeah, yeah. God bless the poodles, man.
I can see why they're
they're
popular,
fun dogs.
You know, they don't shed. Yeah. They've got this lovely coat, and the poodle, especially if it's a standard poodle, is usually a really smart and mellow and conscious animal.
Oh,
you know,
really?
It's one of my favorite breeds. Yeah, they're just really good citizens.
Good citizens. So, we need more of those. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is good citizens. Weren't they hunters, hunting dogs at one point?
I think so.
Years
I think
ago,
so.
Over in England and stuff like that, huh?
Yeah.
Well, Doc, you're fun to talk to. We love your work. Thank you, and we love you. And it's vitalanimal.com, and you have courses, so people could, and that's one thing you really, I like about your work, is you're trying to encourage people to, if you're going to have a kid for 15, 20 years, hopefully, you know, do some work, right? And dig in mm-hmm. and have some fun and really get to know what they're all about and how they're working. It's important, huh?
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The more you learn, the more you can do a better job, and the more your animals are going to thrive.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to do a little plug for this. This is, we don't have a financial interest in this, but have you ever seen these little flea traps? They're white and you plug them in. Have you ever seen these guys?
With a light and a yeah. sticky tape or yeah. something? Sure.
Man, they are, I mean, they really will catch some fleas, I'll tell you what.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you can make a homemade one with a shallow sure. dish and some detergent
yeah.
over a nightlight.
Oh, yep. really? The same way? Yep. They'll just jump yep. in there. So there's a really cool one. We have about three or four of them we put out every spring, and they'll catch some fleas, and they're called Spring Star. They're like $15, Amazon mm-hmm. Prime, and they got these little sticky things, and you plug them in, and they'll just catch a lot of fleas. So that's yep. a very safe, non-toxic way to keep as many of them out of the house as you can, right?
Boy, absolutely.
It's pretty cool. And you like that, for topical, you like the, you still big on the cedar thing? Which one that you turned me on 2 years ago?
Yeah, the Wonderside is good both in the environment and topically, especially if you're living in a tick-infested area. So it's a big repellent of the ticks and one of the few things that kills them safely.
Do you want to hear my quick tick story? You're going to love this guy. We had some really challenges with ticks for years, and I didn't have any. All the good old boys here out in Dripping Springs say, well, you got to have fire ants and they'll eat the ticks, right? So mm-hmm. So I went to my neighbors. I didn't have any fire ants. I went to my neighbors down the road and got a whole bunch of fire ants in a trash bag, and I spread them all over the place, right? And you can't see all the fire ants all we have, but we don't have any ticks. Haven't had them.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I think they eat them. I don't know.
Just, yeah.
And the dogs figure out how to not walk in them. They get pretty smart pretty quick.
Yep. Biological control.
Biological control, yeah. I guess they're the only really natural predator for ticks, aren't they? Oh, I guess they're wasps do. I think wasps do as well.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, Doc, thanks a lot. We appreciate your work. Vitalanimal.com, Dr. Will Faulkner. We really appreciate you coming on from time to time. People love it.
My pleasure, Patrick. Thanks for having me.
Yes, sir. Our pleasure. Dr. Will Faulkner, he's a Doodles vet, and we don't see him very often, which means that he's doing a good job. That's right. We talk to him from time to time. Thanks for your ongoing support of One Radio Network. We apologize for missing about half an hour of the show this morning live. The internet went out. It's really been solid. And today it went off. They dismissed. I had a big problem, nothing off and on, but they fixed it. So the whole podcast is available. We'll get it up in about an hour or so. And it's on oneradionetwork.com. We'll see you tomorrow with Open Phone Friday. We have lots to talk about. So I love you all very much. Thanks for your support.
From the Hill Country in Texas, broadcasting worldwide, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.